My name is Jill Meredith Wolf. I'm 37 years old. Today is January 4th, 2017. I'm at the Chicago Cultural Center with my friend and fellow advocate, Amanda.
My name's Amanda Holt-Marsh. I'm 46, and today is January 4th, 2017. I am at the Chicago Cultural Center, and my relationship to Jill is we are fast friends and fellow advocates.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm so glad that you're here. Welcome to Chicago.
Thank you.
I really feel quite lucky to be sitting across from you and getting some of your time while you're here briefly. And our joining force is really advocacy around Hep C.
Definitely.
So if you're cool just sort of starting there, yeah. I'd love to hear anything that you have to say or your thoughts about the hepatitis C virus. And you, that is not a trick question.
Okay. It's a very open-ended question. My thoughts about hepatitis C is it's been a whirlwind. I got a letter in 97, I believe, the end of 97, because I had donated blood. And so I got a letter from the Indianapolis Board of Health that I needed to come down. And I got the letter and just knew I had AIDS for sure, because I was a junkie. Of course I had AIDS. So I called my best friend. I was like, I'm going to need you to drive me. I'm going to be a wreck because I'm getting ready to go have somebody tell me I have AIDS and yada, yada. And went down there and they said I had hepatitis C, which I knew nothing about. I'd heard of, like, my mom would always say I'll get hepatitis if I play around. I used to collect golf balls outside our country club in a dumping ground. I'd go into these garbage dumping dumps in Muncie, Indiana, and collect golf balls. And she said that's how you get hepatitis C. So, I mean, that's how you get hepatitis. I didn't know
hepatitis
there
was, A.
I didn't know there were like G, F. I don't even know.
Oh, yeah, all the way through
this week. But yeah, so I went in and the nurse, she told me I had hepatitis C and she was correct, but she described hepatitis B. And so I went home and was told I had to call. I had a stagehand / audio engineer, and I had just been done what was called the Uncle Sam Jam at our veterans memorial and had 2 gallons of water that me and my 5 other crew members shared the entire day. So they said I needed to go call those people and tell them that they were at risk for having hepatitis. And somewhere in the process, I got somebody that knew something who was like, do you have B or C? Which is it? Because you're talking about B, but you're saying you have C. So turned out I had C, and I didn't have to call everybody I ever knew. And the nurse that looked at my file and said that, before she hung up the phone, gave me some advice, which was really awesome advice, and which came from nurses more than doctors, which was take milk thistle. Take milk thistle, look into that, and later on hit another nurse who said, you need to be taking on an empty stomach. I believe that actually helped. But
it helped with your liver.
I believe it helped keep my liver looking good or keeping me healthy, keeping whatever needed to happen so that later on down the line, when it came time for me to be evaluated and get on Harvoni, I could be told that I was too healthy to take it. But so I got little tricks along the way from usually from nurses as far as things that actually made a difference.
Yeah.
But so that was kind of the kickoff for that whole thing, was just learning what nobody knew. It's not like anybody
was 20 years ago.
Knew. This was
1997. Yeah. We just hit 2017. Yeah. Can you believe it? Yeah. 20 years ago. Lots have changed.
Honestly, feels longer.
It feels longer. Huh? Lots has happened.
Yeah. At least in relationship to the disease, it feels longer. But, yeah.
You've had quite a dance with it, huh?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, just even learning about it, like, I was pretty alone. I didn't know anybody else that had it. The first person I chose to tell, which is a high school friend, old friend, didn't immediately behave like I had leprosy, but within a couple weeks, my best friend, who I live with now to this day, same best friend since I was 17, he was moving in with him. This is 20 years ago. And he and I had a house together, and he was moving out of my house. I was moving, and he was moving in with our other friend, the first person I chose to tell, besides Kyle, who's the guy who was with me and took me to the... So first he tells Kyle that he doesn't really want me in the house, and that Kyle's like, well, I mean, she might not, if I tell her that, she might be more than okay without coming in the house. This is after we've moved him in, and I actually built a room in his basement for him. But then he told Kyle that if he was going to still be around me, that he couldn't live there. And within a week, had Kyle move out because he didn't want somebody that was going to be that close to somebody that had the disease going to the bathroom in his house. Mm. So that's,
wow,
that's kind of my kickoff with it. And it was really, like, lonely for a little while until I started actually, like, either meeting people that knew people or realizing that it wasn't just, like, a one in a billion hardcore junkies are the only people that would ever have it.
Yeah. How did you start learning that? I mean,
it's fuzzy. So my first information all came from the Board of Health, and I did call them, like, call those nurses a bit in the beginning, and a lot of times had different information from nurse to nurse, mm-hmm. So it's a little weird knowing what to go with. So I always played the site as safe. So I was told that I had to tell every person that I had sex with before I had sex with them that they could get the disease. And they really kind of made it sound like heterosexual, normative, mm-hmm. non-fetish type mm-hmm. stuff mm-hmm. was still pretty transmittable, which right. I don't believe that it is.
It is not.
So it's really hard knowing because it was even, especially with doctors, that their information was not the same. It's like the whole, and so I kind of would just use common sense and maybe my opinion of that doctor to where I, whether or not I believe them or how much I believe them. So I kind of think the whole transmission outside of drug use happens a lot more with like using each other's toothbrushes and making out right after both of you brush your teeth, mm. I think is probably a thing that's overlooked because the
gums
and bleeding and how you don't always see the blood and yada, yada. But that's my theory on it. I don't even think I got that from a doctor. That was just from evaluating all the different doctors. I definitely had some doctors that were like, we don't know, and if you can't be kissing people. And I was told that I was putting people at risk if I open mouth kissed them. Mm. So, you know, it's really been really weird because some people treat it like you have leprosy, and yet I was allowed to fight, like tried to get pillow fighting off the ground as a form of fighting. And I was a pretty good fighter, and I drew blood, and they seemed to have no, mm-hmm. I mean, they just seemed to like be like, we don't want to hear that you have hepatitis C, because I was concerned with contaminating people that I was beating, you know, like, kind of got out of that. It didn't really take off, but it's just really bizarre how you can be where it shouldn't even be a big deal and they treat it so extreme, and then when you actually have blood present and people act like they don't know what it is or they don't care, they're not worried about it, it's not AIDS, so who cares? I don't know.
So what I'm really fascinated by, I mean, knowing you for what, 30 minutes at this point, you're a real smart chick. I mean, you were given like really misinformation. To yeah. which then you kind of like found your own right information, right? You built a room in someone's house. I don't even, probably you could just build a house for me right
it's
now.
It's a grow room, but yeah.
Hey, it's still a room, right? It takes some science, it takes some brains, you know. Sound engineer, kind of like find all these things like, wow, like you got some skills, huh?
I don't know. I would call myself, if we can get away from political correctness.
Please.
I mean, my nickname I gave myself 25 years ago is Half-Tard because I test like this highly intelligent individual and Mensa. I could get Mensa if I want to, I guess. But I really struggle with passing first grade. So like there's just this huge disconnect between the learning disabilities I have and, you know, how that's portrayed. So I had to get a GED. I was the fourth lowest in my ranking in my class. Not that I graduated. I mean, I got a GD, but I mean, I really struggled with school. And I mean, there's all these other factors. So the little bit they did know, my mom was kind of like holding back. Mm. And she had some weird kind of Munchausen by proxy, kind of like, I don't know. She got a lot of tension as long as I was a troublemaker and didn't have a learning disability. So she kind of like repressed some of that stuff. But it's hard knowing though, so long ago, and they didn't know all this stuff that they know now.
So. Right. And so here you were, one of the lowest in the class and probably the most brilliant.
I doubt the most brilliant.
One of. But, at least brilliant in your own.
I test very smart. I would say I'm really not that smart. Stupid is as stupid does, and I am incredibly stupid sometimes. I'm like dumbfounded. Like, people that know me are kind of amazed. And idiot savant is something I've been called many times, because if you don't know me long, I can come off as one or the other. But if you know me for a while, I'm both. Hmm. So I don't know. But
what month were you born in?
March.
Hmm. Birthday's coming up.
Yeah. I can't believe how old I am.
A lot has happened in your 40 some odd years, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say I've had some better or worse, a lot of life experiences, mm-hmm. probably more than most 47-year-olds, which is in some ways beautiful, in some ways bitter. You know? But I'm sure we all have our stories.
We all have our stories, and I get the opportunity and the sort of the joy of collecting yours. And sort of going back to some of these, call yourself an idiot savant. If I put a piano in front of you, would you just like be able to play me some kind of score of sorts?
Yeah, I have to work very hard at most things. The thing that is kind of bizarre, I guess, is kind of the weird. I'm very mathematically inclined, but I can't I don't understand how my mind gets the answer all the time, which was also a big problem because there was a big show your work thing. Mm. And I wasn't necessarily doing things the way they taught us. I mean, I couldn't really pay attention to what she was saying. I'd go in class and read or sleep, usually sleep. But I could come up with the answer, but my work, I couldn't do it. So then I just started writing anything, and then they started looking closer, and they're like, that doesn't even make sense with the problem. And I mean, I was literally like trying to copy people's work, not their answers, just the work. So it looked like whatever I was doing on the paper that I'm supposed to show them. So, you know, my aptitude seems to be very left brain, but I tend to live on the right side of my brain. I'm very average artistically and all that. That's the world I live in. Mm-hmm. You know, I love music. And
so, you know, walk me through, I mean, if we sort of hover above this young person who obviously has a lot of smarts, but our education system isn't geared towards supporting you, and they don't know what they don't know, right?
Right, sure.
You're smart. You know the answer. Don't quite know how to get there. It's got some stuff going on at home. And one of the terms that you use, and I'm using this in quotes, but this is audio so you can't hear it, but junkie. Mm-hmm. How did this young person who had the answer, didn't quite know how she got there, right? And sort of whatever circumstances, you mentioned your mom and some things and your experiences, and here you are sitting in front of me with a chronic virus that is curable.
Right.
And we'll help you get there. Okay. We'll get you there, okay? Your liver's smiling, the milk thistle's like, hey. But tell me how you think, at least sitting right here, right now, and I may ask you this next week and your answer would be different.
Right.
But how did this young person who knew the answer, didn't quite know the work to get there, sitting in front of me today, calling himself a idiot savant, junkie, I can go build you a room, I can do some sound engineering and all these things.
How did I get?
I mean, tell me the impact of sitting in a classroom and then eventually making some choices that land you with a chronic virus.
You know, so I'm from Muncie, which is a smaller town in Indiana, and was born in 1970 in Muncie when they literally wrote a book called The Middle, which was about Muncie because it represented numerically the middle of America.
Middle America.
Like, it was statistically what they were talking about. So, it was a really... It was a great town to grow up in. A lot of people dog out Muncie, but I grew up, at least when I lived there and where I lived and my socioeconomic background, it was very ideal because I have a very abusive mom, but without her just beating the shit out of me or molesting me, that abuse is minimized by most from the outside. My parents are rich. And so my last name is Marsh. We have grocery store chain. My grandfather founded that. It's a little bit of power, especially in the Muncie area. With that, nobody's going to mess with my mom, even people that might have been suspicious that things weren't right. So that all played a big factor. But I think I was doing all right in school because before core testing and a lot of the things, teachers had a lot more freedom. So I had these parents through school. School was actually a really, it's very hard for me to make myself be there all day because I couldn't do what they wanted me to do. But at the same time, teachers that I grew up with were incredible and really probably saved me from being a serial killer, I think. Like between the church I grew up in, my neighbors, the teachers, I believe that that's the difference between me and, say, a girl named Paula Cooper, who was the youngest girl to be put on death row in Indiana, who's a friend of mine, was a friend of mine. I think the difference between her and I is the environment that I came up in and the safety nets of the school and just a small community and being raised in a church. My entire dad's side of the family was within one block of our house. Like, we were all basically a block away from each other.
So you had this village of people that weren't your biological parents.
A great network outside my biological parents.
Yeah.
And my dad's a good man. He's not a good parent, but he's a good man. Mm-hmm. So I'm not trying to trash him or anything. But so I think I was getting by. And when I was 13, my parents decided to move to Indianapolis.
How far is that from Muncie?
1 hour.
Okay.
And I spent, my grandparents lived there. My brother's a big-time tennis player, and his coach was there. So I was there almost every weekend through the school year anyway. But moving there is a big difference. And then she kind of, I'd been tested and they said I was nonverbal and right-brained. But then my aptitude was left-brained, right? That's what they came up with after this testing. And this doctor had this 2-hour tape because he's like, I'm going to give you a lot of information. You're going to need to re-listen to this for my parents. So we sat in an office and he recorded everything he said. That tape went on a shelf and was never listened to again. I remember very little of it. But the things that he did say within a year, she'd, like, repress that information. Like, she told my sixth-grade teacher, but then it was kind of right back to not acknowledging there's anything. So when we moved to Indianapolis, I was sent to Park Tutor, which to come out of the school I went into and struggled to pass first grade, but test, you know, like a sixth grader, and then go to Park Tutor, which has a lot of writing, by the way, not a lot of circled answers. I don't even think I passed eighth grade. I think they just kind of waved me into ninth grade and into public school. And there's a lot of damage done in that time. And then at the end of my freshman year, when I was kind of trying to rebalance from that first year move, at the end of the year, my mom kind of wanted to get rid of me because it was my brother's last year home before he'd go away to college. So she put me in a psychiatric ward from the day after my freshman year to, like, 2 days before my sophomore year. And that, like, broke me.
Yeah.
So I was kind of, I mean, there's the everyday telling you you're a piece of shit, you're a slut, I was slutty before I knew what slutty meant and whatever. All that stuff. You can't hear it every day without believing it. And eventually I just did think I was worthless. And I think I was trying to die. I mean, I tried suicide a little later after that. I think that's the beginning of me trying to kill myself, not wanting to live. But maybe even when I wasn't trying to kill myself, all my behaviors were incredibly self-destructive. And I couldn't dare life enough, you know, dam sliding or, you know, riding on the outside of cars and the roof and whatever. But everything just became about, like, pushing it because I didn't give a shit, you know. So that's, of course, when you go exploring on drugs. In eighth grade, even at Park Tutor, there's a lot of rich kids. And they had, like, prescription drugs and stuff. And I was pretty open to any. I mean, I was pretty miserable once I left Muncie.
Yeah.
And, being in a private school that was very far away from our house. So when I was at home, I didn't know anybody around me, and she wouldn't drive me to where my friends lived. So it was a weird year. It was a tough year. And I think I was probably going to make it through. I felt like once I got back into public school, I was about to kind of, like, you know, just be able to make it and maybe not be able to pass high school, but, like, stay out of trouble and, like, you know, find my way socially and things like that. And she put me in that psychiatric ward, and it was really just like, fuck you, people. Mm. I don't trust my parents. Yeah. I don't trust anybody, you know, so fuck it.
And that village that you had, you didn't have access to them.
She did a lot to keep me from contacting my previous life as well. And, like, it just became this thing. Like, Muncie was very, I think she's borderline personality disorder, honestly, but I think that she viewed Muncie as very low class, and like she was returning to her home. She was from Broad Ripple High School in Indianapolis, and she wanted to return with this wealthy man she'd married and put it in people's face is what I think. And I didn't really fit into that picture. My brother was great for that picture. I was not so great for that picture. So, yeah, whatever.
I'm so glad you're alive.
Why, thank you. It's pretty amazing. I had some pretty decent attempts there. So can't explain it, but.
We don't have to. You're sitting here.
I'm finally glad myself. How about that? It took me a lot of years to be like, okay, so I don't get to choose when I go. Maybe that's cool.
That is cool. Tell me some of the ingredients that you'd put into what was, you say, finally now you could sit here and say, you're glad you're here.
Yeah.
What are some of the ingredients that went into making that be so?
Well, I think continuing to survive when I shouldn't is a big thing. Like, you just get to a point where you're like, Jesus, I came to believe in, like, whether it's combined consciousness, God is such a simple term. If you're raised in Christianity, we'll just call it God. I'm not, my relationship with my higher power doesn't give a shit what I call it. So, or if I think it's multiple people or a girl or a boy or nobody or whatever. So, but I do think there's something, and my attempts, some of them were just really good. Like, I almost want to brag on them because I want people to explain to me how the hell I'm alive, you know, like, right? So, but as I get older, you know, you do damage. Mm-hmm. Like, so if you don't off yourself, you've then got damage or left to live with whatever you damaged in the process of trying to kill yourself. So, you know, I had done enough to my liver from drinking vodka and taking bottles of Tylenol and that kind of thing that I probably didn't start out all that great before I got hepatitis C. But, you know, surviving all the self-destruction and a weird epiphany, a very strange epiphany, a guy that one of the first people I met when I moved to Indianapolis, who somewhat similar to trajectory, my mom never liked him. Way later on, I started dating him, and he was living in California, so he moved here, and he still worked in California, so he was flying back and forth, and she was getting ready to move to Texas to be close to my brother, and he came in, and she always hated him, and he came in. This is years later. She hasn't seen him for over a decade, and he's now, like, established and wealthy, and this kid, she didn't even want to tell me messages when he'd call. All of a sudden, she's like just in love with him. We go to this dinner. And anyway, he was an abused child. And his dad, he moved from California to Indianapolis because his dad had to come get him away from his mother. And he was adopted. And anyway, we get done with the dinner and we walk out. And he's like, I will never, never want to be around you while you're around your mother again. He said, the minute she was in your face, your eyes glazed over. And the truth is, it's like the first time I ever thought about it, I couldn't even remember anything I'd said in that restaurant. But I would basically become this other person when she was around and wasn't really aware of it. And he was like, you are so very clearly abused. Well, it was kind of the first time. All I'd ever heard is, hey, you're not beat. You grew up wealthy. You had a freaking boat growing up. Your parents made you drive a Porsche when you crashed your car. You know, like, what? Wake up, girl. You're privileged. You're privileged. You're privileged. Well, this guy's privileged too and abused too. And he was like, I don't know what happened to me when I was little, but whatever happened to you is way fucking worse. And he's like, because it is bizarre. It is creepy. It is all this. And that just started this kind of epiphany that, like, that isn't right. And I had had a daughter. I just 1 year had a daughter. And that made it different too, is like the things that you say to a little girl, now that I have a little girl, that's not, like, she couldn't possibly love me and treated me the way she treated me. So within a few months of that dinner, I cut her out of my life, and I've never spoken to her since. And that helped. I mean, like, time away from her and not hearing that tape coming from her, you know, then I had to fight just my own internal tape. It might have sounded like her, but I didn't have, you know, I wasn't fighting two thoughts, you know, or something like that. But as the longer I get away from her and the longer I live, the more I see the beauty and the opportunity and the fact that it's all so short anyway. You know, why rush it? it's gonna be over like that. And not getting treatment for hepatitis C. When I got on interferon and pegintron, so I've done a run of that.
So we're talking years ago.
So this was in 2002.
Okay.
That kicked in a weird thing. First of all, it stimulated my frontal lobe, so it made me violent. Mm. But it also kicked in. It was a really beautiful thing in certain ways because I was like, this shit sucks. This is horrible. There are days I can't get up off the floor. I have this brand new daughter. Her father was using it against me and really cruel about it. And so should I do this? So I kind of had to make a choice right then. Am I going to live or am I going to die? Because if I'm going to choose to live, I need to inject this crap once a week and take these pills every day and, you know, make real sure it's worth it. And so I kind of took an inventory and decided, you know, life is short enough. I'm going to go ahead and try to live. And that did change something in me where it was suddenly like, you know, I used to not care what happened to me. I would have donated my body to science if it would save two people to destroy myself. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of changed all that. It's like, you know what? This is about me surviving and living and seeing what life has. And it just, all that kind of came together and just changed my perspective. So even when I have suicidal thoughts now, I do know they will pass. So
it's true.
So and that the other thing is she had convinced people I had bipolar and they had me on drugs for a really long time that were making me suicidal and it got off Effexor and I mean, very rarely ever think that life is that bad. I mean, it, literally those drugs were the very worst part of it, you know.
And you were on it for how long?
I was on a bunch of them. So she told people I had bipolar when I was, 17, maybe. So off and on with, Zoloft and Wellbutrin, mm-hmm. which is the least, that was the only one that made any sense at all to me. But Depakote, I've been on a lot of different
And then drugs. You went on interferon. And that was in your 20s?
And then I got pregnant with her and refused to take that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as she was born, because I had coverage from getting pregnant,
yes.
and because I couldn't, through my company, through Proton Productions where I work, couldn't get insurance because I had pre-existing conditions. So my doctor, I have I'm raised Presbyterian. So the clinic I go to is a poor people's clinic or whatever through the Presbyterian church. And the doctor that's used to be the only doctor that's still there that was there from the beginning, Dr. Louis, is a saint, angel, wonderful man. And so as soon as my daughter was born, he's like, we got to get you on this stuff because they're never going to give you coverage otherwise. So, and once you're on it, if they pull your coverage, then I've got people you can talk to and they'll finish it, you know, they'll let you finish. And so we did that. And I did get pulled off of it after 3 months. I didn't have enough of a support network and too young of a child. And but yeah, that's how I decided to actually do something about treatment. It was Dr. Louis after I had my daughter really pushed me. And then I did a biopsy. And he said I had a bunch of scar tissue and that we didn't have any time. And I needed to get on it right away. Mm-hmm. And that was a man named Dr. Odolowo.
How long ago was that?
That was in 2002, which is really funny because when I went to get the Harvoni this last, a year ago, mm-hmm. on January 11th, 2016, I got HIP 2, a Healthy Indiana Plan. So now that we have Obamacare, right? Universal, what do we call it?
The Affordable Care Act.
There you go. Thank you. So, you know, I thought all these things would be different. Not a whole lot's actually changed, but I mean, I guess the bureaucracy of it has changed, but I got in to do that blood work, and they said they didn't need to do biopsies anymore. They could tell how scarred my liver was by just by blood. Mm-hmm. And they said I didn't have any scar tissue. Mm-hmm. So how do you go, because your liver regenerates, but scar tissue does not. So how do you go from over 60% scar tissue as an estimation, it was around 65%, to having none, you know? Maybe because they don't want to pay for Harvoni.
There's a very number of reasons. Off when this isn't recording, we'll talk about that because we don't want to. But ultimately, it could have been sampling error. It could have been a number of things.
Sure.
But yes, it definitely begs the question of.
Well, and then I tried to get the from Methodist Hospital where my biopsy was done. I tried to get that paperwork to show my own the Presbyterian clinic. I wanted to show them that blood sample is not right because you can't reverse that. Well, they didn't. We get rid of our records after 13 years. I've never heard of that, but they couldn't get my records. Mm. And all this stuff just makes me suspect after all my experience with doctors and games. And
understood.
But I don't know what I think about trying to determine scar tissue by by blood tests. But
well, so in terms of where we are now with this, last year you applied for the medication that you got denied for.
Right. Two years ago, I applied for coverage. A year ago, I went in and actually got into a gastroenterologist and went through all that. And he actually did say they would cover me under certain conditions, which even before he got in there, he's like, well, they pretty much deny everybody. And then I have he had somebody that worked in his office whose job was basically to go to bat. Mm-hmm. But he came back with, you can do it, but you have to come in. You have to come in today and be tested for drugs, which I was totally clean and didn't have a problem with. Although I have a problem with that. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
I don't take vaccinations anymore. And he said I had to have a hepatitis B and a hepatitis A vaccination. And, you know, in debating whether or not to do that, and I actually pray on things and praying on doing that, I oddly had Dr. Winterheimer, who's almost retired, say he wanted to see me because I'm actually seeing this other doctor. And we started talking, and anyway, he got in contact with Dr. Otolowo, who said that that was not the state mandate. That was that doctor. And so he basically, I had already talked to that doctor, so he's caught in a lie right there. And boom, we're right back to I don't trust doctors. Mm-hmm. I mean, Dr. Winterheimer is the only reason, being pregnant is the only reason I actually get back into them so they can get their grasp and be, let's work on some things, you know, because I just so put off by Western medicine that,
understood.
You know. So I kind of didn't want to deal with him, and I was going to try to get back on Healthy Indiana Plan and go through Dr. Otolowo, who said he wouldn't make me have vaccinations, but they keep not giving me an appointment and then sending me a letter saying that I missed the appointment that they scheduled. So I've spent 4 months just trying to get back on Healthy Indiana Plan. So
one thing you said was that you survive when you shouldn't.
Right.
Right? And you're sitting here in front of me, seemingly thriving. And we can certainly get you to a place where your liver is smiling and cool. Fully thriving, right? excuse me. But I want to know, what do you want to do? What can we do to create together? I mean, obviously, God, whoever she is or isn't, right?
Right.
Isn't ready for you to join some other place that isn't here on Earth yet.
Clearly.
Which I'm happy about, personally. I'm very happy about it. Okay?
I'm happy today, too.
So what are we going to do together? And we got, like you said, like, it would be okay if you went in and did a urinalysis and it would all come up negative, and you'd be okay with that. And
right.
You're totally not okay with that.
No.
And me neither. And we got a world to save. So what do you want to do?
Well, I mean, for me, knowing where I should go or how to focus down to one thing is very, very difficult. I seem to be politically obsessed and can't seem to go very long without going back to that. I would love to affect change in any way through just a very, very messed up system we have here. Beautiful idea that's gotten very convoluted. And, I feel like that doctor, I understand that maybe where he was coming from, like he feels like it's his time. Why should he give time to somebody who might still be on dope and then just go out and get a different disease and die? But he's getting paid to be my doctor. And I've been through a hell of a lot, and I pay my taxes. And so and I had a job that had private insurance, and they didn't want to cover me. And so I don't have a whole lot of humor with that's okay for you to lie because it's your time. You're getting paid for your time. I love doctors that are truly altruistic. There's plenty of doctors that think that they're entitled, that they don't even have to be a good doctor, that they don't need to keep learning when they leave medical school. And you know, so I would love for there just to be more compassion, more empathy within the medical community. Maybe more nurse practitioners and less doctors, a little bit more focus on, why is it that this doctor, the one that lied to me, was the first gastroenterologist that actually had a good personality.
They're GI doctors. I mean, how many GI doctors have good personalities?
No. That's because there's no, I'm like, why am I seeing GI doctor instead of a hepatologist, you know? Well, yes. There's almost none of them, and there's, you know, only certain people want gastroenterology. And so, you know, it just seems like, and I'm sure this is not relevant to hepatitis C, but all across the medical community, there's a lot of nurses that have a lot of knowledge that don't get paid well and don't get treated well. And then there's a lot of doctors kind of walking along, mm-hmm. and they feel like they finished medical school and they paid their loans, so they are entitled, and they will take that, and they will, like, I'd call it a God complex almost. Mm. I kind of see it a lot, and I don't understand why more nurse practitioners, why there isn't more dedication specifically to specific diseases instead of treating it like it's all just gastroenterological, right. You know? So I would do anything that I thought that I could actually make an impact. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't know. I'm a better follower. You seem like a really good leader.
Well, I'm a good follower too, and I'm a good collaborator. Okay. And so I need you, right? I mean, like, you've got some stories that 40 minutes ain't gonna do justice to, and I'm really humbled by the opportunity to sit in front of you, and I'm really glad that. That you survived when you shouldn't. Your body is incredible. And
I think I might be related to Wolverine, actually. But and I'd love to know what it could conquer without constantly fighting a 1.5 million viral load, you know?
Right. Right.
But it's definitely, I'm very thankful that I genetically got a strong body. They could put up with a lot of stuff, and with every bit of maybe unlucky turns, there's been plenty of lucky turns as well. So
yeah,
I've been pretty blessed.
I guess just sort of looking and trying to reduce this down to its most minimum, I'm really grateful to your parents for giving you the genetics that you have. Mm-hmm. And I'm really grateful that you were able to one of the ingredients of cutting your mom off,
right,
to really get you to blossom, because moms are important. Parents are, and they really obviously make a huge impact, and we are able to heal ourselves just like your liver can regenerate.
Right.
You can, and however I can help sort of in your journey with that and getting your liver healed and helping you heal others, you know, you got a lot to share. And I know you say you don't like writing, but you speak amazingly.
Yeah.
So keep speaking.
Well, thank you. Keep working on it, because it comes easier than the writing. I mean, it's not supposed to, theoretically, I guess, but it is.
Theory schmeary.
right? So, well, thank you, and I think this is great. I appreciate all you're doing, and would help any way I can.
Back at you. So any last thoughts, comments, concerns, letters to the editor, anything you'd want to add?
Oh, let's just start treating people. We can cure it now. I don't see what the problem is. Let's just start curing people. No
can eliminate
who they
it,
are,
right?
Instead of only certain people.
Truth. Well, we're working on it. We're working on it. We need you, so come help us.
I will. I will gladly.
Thanks, Amanda.
Thank you.